This is the IBJ podcast for the week of June 8th, 2020, brought to you by the law firm Craig DeVault. I'm Mason King. Welcome back to the podcast, everybody. As you know, we are living through an extraordinary confluence of, it's probably better to say collision, of national and international crises. We probably haven't seen anything like this since 1968, with tumult in Eastern Europe and North Korea, the Vietnam War, several assassinations, including that of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., and major protests on college campuses and in cities across the country. And 2020 isn't even halfway over. We still have a presidential election to get through. But let's bring it back to Friday, May 29th. Indianapolis and much of the rest of the country are just getting back on their feet as restrictions on businesses due to the coronavirus crisis were lifting. A peaceful protest sparked by the police killing of George Floyd in Minneapolis led later in the night to looting and vandalism in Indianapolis. And of course, the same thing happened in many other cities. Indianapolis officials worked with protesters on Saturday to try to avoid violence and property damage in demonstrations that were set for later that night. Again, peaceful protests eventually devolved into a free-for-all. Rocks were thrown, police used tear gas, dumpsters were set on fire, many business storefronts were vandalized, some stores were looted, two people were shot dead, though not by police. On Sunday morning, business owners were out cleaning up shattered glass and boarding up their storefronts, and some were asking, how could city leaders allow this to happen? Monday, the Stadium Village Business Association, a group that represents about 200 businesses in the southern half of downtown, sent a letter to Mayor Hogsett and the City County Council expressing several concerns and frustrations. Eric Wells, the association's president, said that the city's communication with businesses regarding restrictions and curfews has been very poor, and that city leaders don't appear to have a plan for securing and reviving downtown. She also asked the city to help shoulder the costs for businesses to recover from the rioting, saying that it bore some responsibility. The association's criticisms are the subject for this week's edition of the podcast. We'll first speak with Erica Wells, and then we'll speak with a top member of the Hogsett administration for a response. Here's our interview with Erica. Joining me in the IBJ podcast virtual studio is Erica Wells. She's president of the Stadium Village Business Association and the general manager of Chef JJ's Downtown. Erica, thanks for making time to speak with us.
Thank you, Mason. Thanks so much for having me. I really appreciate it.
First, can you just give me a sense of the membership of the Stadium Village Business Association, the kinds of businesses that populate this area of downtown?
Oh, sure. So we're an association of about 200 plus businesses. They vary in range from private dining facilities like myself, restaurants, you know, different services, jewelry stores, flower shop, architects, you name it. We've got lots of variety for sure.
And opposed to kind of the area that is north of Washington Street, which, you know, for downtown, especially in the core, is a lot of like big skyscrapers. I mean, these are much more modest sized businesses usually. They're mom and pops and what we would consider to be small businesses. Is that right?
Correct. Small businesses for sure, most of them. But businesses that have been in the downtown, you know, south of downtown area for a long, long time, 30 plus years, a lot of them.
So let me jump right into what you are hearing from the member businesses right now. What is really top of mind for them as we're in the middle of this week and headed into the weekend?
So top of mind, of course, for them, for a lot of us really, you know, is just frustration, it's fear, you know, it's exhaustion. Frustration from the standpoint that today, right now, it's 1:07 and it's Thursday, and we haven't had an announcement from the mayor as to what the curfew is going to be for the weekend. Now, we all know that there's going to be one through the weekend because that was made pretty clear yesterday, but we don't know if it's 8 o'clock, 9 o'clock. Frustration from things like that, that there's no clear plan. It's more of a day to day. So that's very frustrating. You know, they're frustrated with damage from the recent turn of events this weekend. You know, everybody's been excited and ready to open and just to be deflated, you know, a few days later by being on limited hours, now a curfew and, you know, maybe even fear of not being able to open again at all for a while. Fear of also wondering, are people going to want to come back downtown? You know, are people afraid to come back downtown right now?
You know, that is a wonderful point that I had not even considered. You know, it took downtown so long to sort of break this perception that downtown was a dangerous place. And then seemingly in a weekend, I think we've introduced fear back into the lives of people in the suburbs, you know, who, you know, really had to be cajoled to come downtown.
Absolutely. I can agree with you more. Many years ago, put a plan in place, you know, to really revitalize our city. And we had a vision to transform it and, you know, attract growth and hospitality and arts and people downtown. And we've done, or we were doing a great job of that. And then all of a sudden, with all of the recent activity, you know, it just seems that we've lost that vision or something. And you're right. Local leaders are going to have to figure out a way to get the message out like, hey, you know, we're taking back our city. It's safe. Come back downtown, support these businesses. Because quite honestly, you know, a lot of our business, a lot of our clientele do come from the north side, Carmel, Fishers, Zionsville. I'm guessing right now they're thinking twice about coming downtown.
So obviously this is an extraordinary time for the United States. I don't know how many different ways I've heard this described, other than it's historic.
Right.
And we've been hit by multiple crises in the last few months. Before last weekend, many downtown businesses were just getting their feet under them as restrictions on operations were being lifted because of the coronavirus crisis. So before last weekend, what were the two or three biggest concerns that the businesses in the area had?
Well, before last weekend, honestly, you know, again, still a little frustration because, again, even the reopening plan with the mayor wasn't in sync with the governor. And we weren't, again, given much notice as to when we could open. You know, they were still making notifications 2 or 3 days beforehand versus a week or two. So again, that's frustrating from a business standpoint and a restaurant standpoint. And then again, the whole outdoor dining, you know, was a concern that wasn't clearly thought through. Just all of that overall, and how are we gonna get things back to normal?
I forget where I had read this, but it might have been something that you had written, that when you take a look at some of the ways that other cities are trying to support, you know, businesses in the central business district, that didn't seem like Indianapolis was doing some of the same things.
Correct. Yeah, I mean, you saw in other cities, you know, where they were doing some things for sure, and our city really didn't, and that is definitely one of the concerns and one of the frustrations that we, even Chef JJ's as a small business, had. There were things they could have done, we feel like, and they didn't. They could have said that landlords can't collect rent payments during this time of shutdown. They could have done some type of a tax abatement. You know, there are lots of things that could have been done. You know, okay, you're shut down for 2 months, citizens' gas, utilities, don't charge them utility payments. Because even though our building sat empty, and everything basically off that could be off, we still had a pretty significant utility bill. So those bills were still coming in, but they could have put a stop to certain bills, things that were coming in that were not able to be paid because of the loss of revenue.
And had you had any contact with the city officials about those kind of concerns?
No, I had not. But then when this all kind of came to light, it was like, okay, you know what? Small businesses are getting hit again. Stadium Village is getting hit. Somebody needs to say something.
So as the president of the Stadium Village Association, what was last weekend like? I mean, how were you called into service on Saturday and Sunday in the aftermath of, you know, the two major protests downtown and the subsequent riots?
So as a Stadium Village president, it was more of a reaction kind of thing come Monday. You know, everybody, I think, was still kind of reeling and devastated about what just had happened over the weekend. But yes, I was contacted by definitely lots of our members, you know, hey, what do we do? Here's what happened. You know, I reached out to them to see who all had been damaged to try to kind of survey some of that. Several of them just voiced concerns. Okay, what do we do? And I said, you know what? I'm going to write a letter to the mayor because something definitely needs to be done. We need to take back control of our city and we need to help the businesses downtown rebuild.
For folks who aren't in Indianapolis, can you just give a sense of the kinds of damage that businesses were dealing with?
For us, it was several broken windows, you know, so rocks just thrown through windows. But all of our windows have some type of a rock chip on them. Flower pots were smashed in the street. One of the oldest bars in downtown Indy, Slippery Noodle, who have very old windows that shatter very easily. Pretty much every single window of theirs had a shatter. Spray paint, graffiti, but mostly just lots of vandalism. And we were lucky we didn't have any of the fires. But it was mostly a lot of glass break, just people throwing things through windows or attempting to throw things through windows, shattering windows.
There was some looting, as I recall.
So, and not so much in Stadium Village, but in downtown, yes, there was looting. The Windsor Jewelry Store downtown got hit several times. I saw a video of Crown Liquors downtown. They were looted as well. People just kept going in, taking alcohol. And the interesting thing about that is in that video, not once did I see an IMPD officer anywhere in the vicinity.
I think Cento's Shoes also was looted.
Yes, Cento's, yep, absolutely. And they've been here for, gosh, 30, 40 years easy.
Yeah, it's a long time family business. Do you have a kind of a census or a sense of the extent of the damage or how much, this is going to end up costing, at least for your area?
Oh, I'm sure it's it's tens of thousands of dollars, I'm sure. I'm sure our insurance claim alone is every bit of 10,000. I mean, it's going to be significant.
So would people, hear about this cost and they go, well, you're a business, you have insurance. Is it correct to assume that this is all just going to be covered?
I don't know if it's correct to assume because we don't know. But yes, ideally, all of this should be covered by most businesses' insurance. Yes. And I can see where the argument would come in. Okay, well, it's covered. Why should the city do anything? There's two reasons for that. And that's, and again, I don't want to spend a lot of time on the money part of it because that isn't my focus, but we were all prepared to open, June 1st, indoor dining, which is helping all the restaurants and businesses, et cetera. Now everyone's going to be delayed yet again to reopen because now I have to wait for my windows to be replaced, or I have to wait to, restock my jewelry shelves or restock my liquor store. So now you're going another 2 weeks without revenue coming in. So now how are you coming out of another, coming out of 2 months of not having any revenue, paying bills? So, the government can still step in and do something to help rebuild downtown. And I think that would send a very powerful message to the people, to our constituents in the suburbs. Hey, the mayor's helping rebuild downtown. It's safe. It's secure to get people down here again, because that's exactly what he's going to have to do.
Right. Yeah. And just to back up just a little bit. So as you mentioned, you sent a letter to the mayor and to the city county council expressing a lot of concerns and suggested that the city shoulder at least some of the burden of the cost for the businesses of reopening. So you're not talking necessarily just about damage, but also just the cost of recovery.
Well, yeah, exactly. So, you can put damage in quotes. I'm using air quotes right now. Yeah. Damage can be defined as a lot of things, financial damage, mental damage. I think a lot of people right now, downtown businesses and not just in Stadium Village, are mentally damaged right now. We're all having to go through another, who knows how long, week, 2 weeks of no business or lack of revenue. So I think it's going to depend business to business what that type of financial help is. It could be different for each one. Great, we all have insurance, but some of us have rent payments. Some of us don't. Some of us own our buildings, but we still have taxes. We still have things that we have to pay, but now still have no more money coming in than we did 2 weeks ago.
In what form would that assistance take? Are you suggesting they should just cut you a check, or are there other methods that they could use to help you save on expenses?
Sure, sure. No, I mean, I think to make sure that businesses use those funds properly, I think they could do things, like I said earlier, they can tell the utility companies, hey, any downtown businesses are, waived from paying their utility bills till August 1st. I'm sure lots of these big buildings have high utility bills, or, maybe landlords can't collect rent for the next 2 months. There are things, rather than necessarily giving money directly to that business and hoping that they use it appropriately, that they can do.
One that you mentioned was the potential of maybe giving a building owner a tax abatement on the property taxes as long as they pass that savings on to their tenant.
I don't know that that's what I said. I think.
I'm sorry. Well, yeah, go ahead and explain.
Well, I just, from a business that owns, and I'm sorry, I keep using us as an example, but we own our building. So, the taxes, and this relates to the COVID question that you asked me, I think earlier, we still had to pay our taxes during COVID and we were shut down for 2 months. And if you didn't, you still had, and you were penalized. I guess I feel like, those things could have been put in place by the government that, okay, you don't have to pay your property taxes during the, months that were shut down, and, maybe flip that whole abatement process. I didn't say that they had to necessarily pass it on to the landlord. Pass it on to their constituents. But ideally, yes, if they're not paying property taxes, that in turn helps them to be able to say, okay, you know what, you know, we can not worry about the rent payment this month, or, you know, that sort of thing. I think it all kind of trickles down, or it should.
So you're open to a variety of different.
Yeah. I mean, there's no set. Those were financial suggestions and ideas that, you know, collectively came from myself and our executive committee of Stadium Village, our executive board, and just ways that we can try to put ideas in people's heads, like, hey, oh yeah, that might be a good idea. Maybe that's how we can help, or kind of letting them know what would help small businesses.
And are you thinking that this would just be for the Stadium Village Association businesses, or really suggesting this for all of downtown?
Oh, I think it should be for all of downtown. I mean, while I specifically represent Stadium Village, I mean, I have friends outside of my district, obviously, that are, you know, have been devastated, and I think it should be all around.
The question people have is, well, why should the city be held liable for the damages that are created by looters and vandals who just use this as an opportunity to go wild?
And again, I'm not saying the city should be responsible. I mean, I'm posing a question to our city leaders, you know, about the financial part of it. You know, I think that the city leaders could have done a better job of communicating and taking control of the city so that, you know, Saturday night's events didn't happen, which would have helped greatly minimize the damage. But I think it's, you know, what we always say, you know, we're all in this together. You know, if they can clearly recognize that, yeah, maybe they didn't do things as they should have and put a curfew in place after Friday night, you know, that would have been the first thing I would have done Saturday morning, is put a curfew in place for Saturday through the weekend. Then I think they need to step up and be like, okay, you know what, we have to rebuild the downtown businesses. Financially, they're not able to do it right now. Let's step in and help them.
Yeah. And you said you have larger concerns really about the city leaders having a clear vision and being able to communicate effectively to businesses. Can you tell me a little more about that?
Well, one of the frustrating, or the biggest frustrations through COVID, and, you know, even through what just happened, is just the lack of communication and the lack of planning, in my opinion, by our city leaders. As I said, let's see, almost 20 minutes ago, we're waiting to know about the curfew for the weekend, and now it's 1:24. You know, ideally, I suggested to all of my mayor action advocates that I am in contact with that, hey, he needs to announce this early on Thursday so people can plan for the weekend, restaurants, things like that. But we still haven't heard anything. So it's just that lack of communication. There's no plan. And I want to thank, and this is, I'm sorry, I'm going to jump off of this for a second, but I want to thank Bob Ossley and Kristen, who are city county councilors, that actually took the time to meet with us on Tuesday and let us communicate some of our frustrations. They met with some business owners. So I want to thank them for taking that time. We really appreciate that. But we did communicate these things to them, and we still haven't seen anything changed at this point. But they need to have a plan. How are they taking back the city? And why is it taking so long? You know, they should have had a plan in place, because in my opinion, even a bad plan is better than no plan at all, because they could have made an announcement on Monday. Hey, we're going to have curfew every night now for the next 2 weeks. It's going to be 8:00. Great. That, as a business, helps me plan. But to go from day to day like this is just very frustrating. And it's not leadership. It's not having a clear plan. And they clearly don't.
Is there concern about a wider, more long-term plan for how Indianapolis, or downtown Indianapolis, is going to go forward?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, we, a long time ago, business leaders sat down and put a plan in place to make Indianapolis one of the hot destinations, if you will, or model cities in the Midwest that people wanted to go to. And they successfully started doing that. And we were, you know, progressing greatly, and lots of new restaurants and art and hospitality and just lots of recognition. You know, we were on lots of top lists of convention cities and places to travel and visit for the weekend. And I think if they either don't get back to that plan somehow, or revise that plan or rework that plan, I think that concerns me about what the future of our city and our downtown holds.
The thing that seems really troubling about all of this is that between, you know, the virus and these, and the protests and demonstrations, and specifically the rioting, I mean, it seems like it was like one of these heat-seeking missiles designed to attack downtown, that there were just so many things, like, you know, the convention business is all centered downtown, sports and tourism, you know, on which we build our economy, is all centered downtown. As a downtown business owner, I would think you would really have to be concerned about the future, you know, over the next couple of years, at least, for the viability of downtown.
We absolutely are. And again, I'm just going to go back to what I just said. I mean, it's going to take the city and the city leadership and, you know, all the organizations downtown to get it back on track. So yes, as a downtown business, I'm sure all of the businesses share my pain and my feeling when, yeah, we don't know what the future holds. You know, we're down 90%. We're all struggling to hang on. And how long do we have to hang on before things turn around? And, you know, we really need city leadership to take hold of those reins and do what they need to do and make things great again and get it back on track.
Well, great. Well, this has been super helpful. I really appreciate it.
Well, thank you so much for having me. It's been great talking with you.
All right. Let's take a quick break before we hear from Thomas Cook, Chief of Staff for Mayor Joe Hogsett. First, let's hear from our sponsor. This is the IBJ Podcast.
The IBJ Podcast is brought to you by Krieg DeVault, a trusted and dynamic law firm representing a wide variety of local, regional, and national clients. Committed to each other and to every client, Krieg DeVault prides itself on integrity, professionalism, respect, and excellence. Financial institutions, global manufacturers, national healthcare providers, and successful organizations of all sizes and market focus rely on Krieg DeVault to create innovative and successful business solutions. Connect today at www.kriegdevault.com.
Okay, we're back with the IBJ Podcast. Our next guest is Thomas Cook, Chief of Staff for Mayor Joe Hogsett. Just for your orientation, this interview was taped on Friday, June 5th, a day after our interview with Erica Wells. Joining me now is Thomas Cook. He's the Chief of Staff for Indianapolis Mayor Joe Hogsett. Thomas, thanks so much for making time to speak with us.
I appreciate it.
So the Stadium Village Business Association has a number of concerns. I think the first has to do with communication between the city and local businesses. They're saying that through the coronavirus crisis and now in the week since the racial justice demonstration started, they've been given such short notice on things like loosening business restrictions or establishing parameters for the curfews. They really can't plan effectively for operating. And I'll give you the example that Erica really pointed out yesterday, is that, I mean, the curfews have been announced over the last week, basically on a day-to-day basis. And even though the city reported on Wednesday that there'd be curfews on Friday and Saturday, the times for the curfews weren't reported until this morning, Friday morning.
No, and I mean, let me say at the outset that I believe those frustrations are valid. We are frustrated with the ability to deal with these very real threats to public safety, balancing First Amendment rights, and in the sense of the coronavirus, the public health considerations, with the speed with which we are receiving information at the last second and how that information can be so dispositive, right? And the example on the coronavirus is that much of the batched public health data is released Monday morning or Monday evening, and it takes some amount of time. The city is using Fairbanks, just as the state is, to analyze that data. And so when we've had our announcements be on Wednesday for policies that take effect on the next Monday, that to us is the soonest we could possibly know when big batches of information as to hundreds of new cases, thousands of new cases, and dozens of new deaths in Marion County, which to us are really important. We understand 4 or 5 days for us may seem like a lot of time when we're dealing with data on an hourly basis, but to business owners, it isn't. And we feel those frustrations. It's part of the reason why we have, to the greatest extent possible, tried to adopt the governor's Back on Track plan to at least provide certainty that when we get to particular stages, businesses can plan for what that looks like. And those issues and those considerations, frankly, that might be going incredibly fast as it relates to the coronavirus are exponentially faster as it relates to the demonstrations we've seen over the last few days. And specifically as it relates to curfews, believe me, if we believed that we had all the information we needed to make these decisions the night before, we would. But oftentimes, the work that's being done to determine what would be in the best interest of the public safety and frankly in the best interest of the protesters themselves is based on intelligence data that's gathered overnight and conversations with the organizers themselves. With respect, many of these organizers aren't planning out their weeks in terms of what protests they're going to have and where they are going to have them with a calendar that they can provide us in advance. And you saw on Monday, for example, I believe it was, with the march to the governor's residence, that was not something that had been communicated to us until about 10 minutes before they started walking. And obviously that's a really big difference than walking downtown. Today, for example, we were notified in the last 24 hours that there's going to be a demonstration at a police precinct. Well, that's a lot different than a demonstration downtown. And that information, we are trying to be as responsive as we can be. And we've been in conversation with the Restaurant and Lodging Association, and believe me, we hear the frustrations of these business owners. But I would just say that we are making every effort we can to provide information when we have it. Wednesday was a great example where we knew based on conversations that Thursday and Wednesday would not require a curfew, but we knew Friday and Saturday would. The hours of that were really determinative. You've seen cities going as soon as 6 p.m. and as late as 11 p.m. We wanted to understand where the protests would be before we made those determinations. And, you know, I apologize, frankly, to these business owners. I wish there was something that we could do that could make that easier for them. But frankly, this is just a very difficult time, compounding an already difficult time. And that's something that we apologize for, and we're attempting as best we can to improve on those notice periods as much as possible, even as we're adjusting to the new reality that we wake up to every single day in terms of what these protests look like.
Also, going back to the coronavirus crisis, Erica was disappointed the city didn't do more to provide relief for small businesses. For example, things that other cities had done, like ordering utility companies to continue providing services throughout the public health crisis, even if the business wasn't paying their rates, or ordering landlords to give businesses a grace on rent through the shutdown, or forgiving property taxes for a certain period of time. Were those kinds of things considered?
I would say that they were considered by the General Assembly years ago when they took away the ability for us to do those things. I think every single thing that you just mentioned, with the possible exception of the way we handle property tax collections, has been preempted by state law repeatedly. And in fact, the landlord-tenant relations, as I'm sure folks will remember, was a huge issue during the General Assembly session last year. We don't have local control over things like utilities, things like landlord-tenants. And what we've attempted to do, frankly, is to utilize the tools we do possess, which are frustratingly slim, to address it at a local level. And I do want to give thanks to the governor. I mean, I think where some of this power has been consolidated within state government, he has been wielding that power, I think, effectively and deliberatively. But I understand the frustrations of folks who would like to see their local government doing more. We certainly would appreciate having the authority to do so. But I will say that we have attempted to do what we can. I'd give the example. I applaud the efforts of the governor's office last week to announce a $30 million small business fund here in the state of Indiana to assist businesses. But I would note that prior to that, just in Marion County, we've appropriated $25 million to seed small business paycheck protection program loans through the Indy Chamber. We've allocated $5 million in funding for a PPE reimbursement grant program that will be launching after next Monday. We have an additional $5 million we're appropriating for small business assistance through the state's program to provide funding for Marion County businesses. We had nearly $2 million in funding for rapid response loans through the chamber. I mean, the aggregate amount that we've placed in just direct small business assistance here in Indianapolis is now in excess of, you know, $35 million in appropriated funds for just one county. That we know is insufficient. That is the frustrating reality of the scope and scale of the COVID-19 pandemic, is even if we feel like we are doing much, we know it is too little. And we understand, you know, that businesses are feeling that hurt, and there's very little that government can ultimately do to solve that problem. But we are trying to be as responsive as we can, given the tools we have, to at least put businesses in a better position than they might have otherwise been.
Well, then this is related. I mean, going forward, the Business Association has suggested directly to the mayor and the city council that the city help shoulder the cost of businesses to recover from the damage of last week. And specifically because they say the city did such a poor job securing the downtown and protecting businesses, especially on Saturday. I mean, is that a fair request?
I think it's definitely a fair request. Whether or not that's the most appropriate way to deal with that damage, I think will be determined. And we've been engaging with organizations like the Indy Chamber in downtown Indy, really the conveners of those various stakeholder groups, because there are obviously a number of merchants associations across downtown, and we want to deal with them holistically. I don't know what that final solution will be. I know that a lot of the conversations ongoing right now are what insurance will or won't cover, and I think that's from a building-to-building perspective going to be different. But I will say we're committed to doing what we can, and we're certainly sensitive to the fact that our downtown has always been the focal point of civic activity, and it should be in the future. And we face challenges as a city, and our downtown in particular, but the city as a whole has always emerged stronger. And in many respects, you know, Visit Indy and our civic champions have long said how unique our downtown is. And I think it is unique. It's the most walkable downtown in the country, I think. It's the number one convention city, right? According to USA Today. But at the end of the day, we weren't unique in the last week. Our peer cities have all faced very similar civic unrest due to people who are frustrated, understandably angered, justifiably, and have taken to the streets, and that there have been people within those demonstrations who have sought to do violence and frankly have damaged not just the businesses, but probably the movement as a whole in terms of their ability to clearly communicate their message. Columbus, Ohio, Chicago, Milwaukee, Kansas City, Omaha, Cleveland, all of these Midwest cities experienced dozens upon dozens of damage buildings and businesses, millions in damage across the Midwest, across the country. And I don't say that to diminish what happened here in Indianapolis, but just to say that these issues are ones that we're tackling as a nation right now. And here in Indianapolis, we've always had a civic community that has been directly invested as not just corporate residents, but corporate citizens. That is what we've relied on for public-private partnerships in the past to build great things in our downtown. And I think that that same spirit will likely be what we need in order to rebuild our downtown here in the coming days and weeks, not just from a capital standpoint, but frankly, from a community standpoint. And we've already seen businesses, small and large, reach out to say, we don't just want to repair our windows, we want to repair relationships between ourselves and the neighborhoods. And whether it's Lillian Cummins and some of our largest corporate partners that are obviously launching huge corporate responsibility and social awareness campaigns, or just the small business associations that want to participate in that. We think we can walk and chew gum, so to speak, at the same time of providing assistance to these businesses, but also help lead community in a conversation that hopefully addresses, at least in a meaningful way, the impetus behind the outcries we've seen on our streets over the last few weeks.
What about specifically this sentiment about what happened on Saturday night? I know that there were people that we encountered on Sunday when we were doing our reporting, you know, who were cleaning up and each essentially saying, how could the city let this happen? Is it fair to say the city failed to protect the businesses and property on Saturday night?
I wouldn't say that there was failure, so to speak. I would say that there was simply a situation that in some respects could not be controlled due to the size of the crowds that came downtown and the speed with which that situation developed. You know, I don't want to in any way, shape, or form dissuade anyone from questioning the decisions that were made. We are ourselves being incredibly reflective about what was done. And I think you've seen over the last 4 or 5 days, the city has continually tried to work with both our law enforcement and our public works departments to say, what could we do better today that we didn't do yesterday? But as it specifically relates to Saturday, you had a situation where within minutes, within a very short period of time, something that was a peaceful protest became violence and disorder. And there were moments Saturday evening where IMPD, state police, or other law enforcement partners were focused exclusively on allowing IFD to get downtown to put out fires. And when you get to a point where you're having to deal with the safety of your law enforcement and public safety officials, in addition to the safety of the community, that is going to be a situation that is difficult. And it was. Certainly, we are looking to see if there are things that we can learn from that experience. But as I said, I don't believe that there was really a city in the Midwest who was able to completely avoid the type of civic unrest we saw. And I don't say that because I want to embrace a fatalism about what occurred Saturday night, but I do want to acknowledge that I think the men and women of IMPD, certainly the men and women of our fire department and of our other law enforcement partners, were doing all that they could in that moment to protect as many people and as many properties as they can. And it wasn't possible to protect every property downtown. And that's unfortunate. It's something that we feel we're going to be doing everything we can to make this weekend be a more successful weekend, not just, and a more safe weekend, not just for the businesses, but also for the protesters themselves, many of whom were put into harm's way. And we obviously saw deaths downtown, gunshots ringing out, and we're going to be taking those efforts seriously again this weekend.
And then just one more specific question about Saturday. Why not establish the curfew on Saturday?
Conversations about a curfew obviously began Saturday. And there were a number of considerations made, not the least of which was the fact that local curfew law does not permit the arrest of individuals for violating curfew. You can only write a ticket. And the way you arrest an individual for being out, so to speak, is actually through a violation of the travel ordinance, the colored travel restrictions that people are familiar with, green, yellow, and red. We were not able to go to a red travel advisory Saturday afternoon because of a completely understandable public health order that had been issued at a state level banning counties from having red travel advisories. And given the late hour, given the need to essentially work with the governor's office to rescind their order and allow us to do that, and frankly, given the fact that from a law enforcement perspective, we were advised that it would in no way, shape, or form affect the crowd that was already gathered downtown and had planned to gather downtown, it was determined that that was not going to be a restriction that would produce a different outcome than if we had put it in place. Sunday morning, obviously after the damage, and especially given the smaller crowd sizes that were anticipated for Sunday on, we worked with the governor's office and the governor rescinded that restriction on travel advisories and we've put a curfew in place. But I think even with that in place, you've seen, we have not sought to use that as a way to arrest every individual who's out after the curfew. I think it has been a way for us to encourage those who are not directly related to these demonstrations to not come downtown and be a bystander, to not have individuals who don't want to participate in the demonstration but may want to take advantage of it to not come downtown. You know, the determination was made that that tool wouldn't have been effective Saturday. It was implemented for the nights that followed. It was rescinded in the middle of this week, and we put it back in place for this Friday and Saturday. And that sounds complicated. I know it's frustrating. The hours have changed, but these determinations have been made with Homeland Security in consultation with state law enforcement. Every morning, we're going to continue to do those things that we think will help best protect the community.
In general, I think, you know, Erica wants to know, what's the plan? What is the plan for getting downtown back on its feet? What's the vision?
Well, it's all of these issues inextricably linked, right? I think that it's a global pandemic. It's an understandable and important national discussion about the way in which discrimination has permeated our culture and our country since its founding. And I think if anybody could tell you that they had every one of those issues worked out to a T, I'm not sure you should believe them. But I will say that we're going to continue to put resources to bear to help businesses weather the COVID-19 storm. We are going to be working with downtown stakeholder groups to help businesses return to form. And frankly, not just us. There's a community effort underway just this Saturday, in which they'll be rebuilding and rehabbing some of the businesses on Ohio Street that were affected. I think in some respects, while we will be releasing those additional details at the end of the day, I think the plan boils down to relying upon the things that helped build our downtown to begin with, which is that this city has always shown a willingness to come together and to do things that others may not thought we are capable of doing. And whether that's the sports strategy in the 80s, whether that's the Super Bowl bid that defined our city over the last decade, or whether it's the issues that are happening right now where we're seeing the community come together, I think we have faith that the things that have proven successful in the past will lead us to success in the future. And that's more about people than policies. And it's more about the culture of the city. And we're, as government, going to put in place the tools. But at the end of the day, that solution is going to come from outside the city county building, not within it. And we're going to be there to support that every step of the way.
What can the city do to assure people who don't live downtown that it's safe to return?
Well, I think that the downtown has always been our safest neighborhood. It's also our fastest growing neighborhood. It's also been the center of large gatherings in the past, right? I mean, we've always been a place that can host large gatherings, and it just so happens that the large gatherings we've been hosting over the last week are about highlighting those things that are unjust rather than celebrating those things that bring us joy. But I think they're no less important. We all hope that if these words turn to action, that will be to a point soon where pandemic restrictions can be lifted and the community can come together and start to have those moments of joy again downtown. I wish I could say it's going to happen in 1 day, 3 days, or 5 days, but at the end of the day, when you have a 400-year history of systemic racism on a piece of land as we do, I think it's to be expected that you're probably going to have to take some time to address that. But at the end of the day, I will tell you there are people right now eating on Mass Ave at the same time that these protests are occurring. And I've gone and walked with these protests, especially this week, and you've got folks who are taking advantage of our downtown businesses and are going to continue, I'm sure, to do that. And I don't think it's a necessarily an or proposition that you can't have downtown be open at the same time that you have residents of our city using it as a place to have their voice be heard. And we're going to continue to do everything we can to provide a safe environment for all those things to happen simultaneously in the short term and in the long term to help our downtown return to what it is now, but certainly will be to a greater extent in the future, which is a wonderful place to live, a wonderful place to work, and then the centerpiece of our state's entire tourism, sports, and entertainment strategy.
Well, Thomas, thank you so much for giving your
perspective. No, I appreciate your time, and we're going to keep working on these issues.
My thanks again to Erica Wells and Thomas Cook. As you might expect, the latest issue of IBJ tackles the question of where downtown can go from here now that it's at a crossroads. We have coverage from Greg Andrews, Mickey Shuey, Lindsay Erdody, Sam Quinn, and Kirk Christian. And Mark Allen examines how Wish TV Channel 8 has covered the protests, their sometimes violent aftermath, and the city's response. Last year, Wish was purchased by Indianapolis native Duwan McCoy, who became the only black owner of a TV station in a top 50 U.S. market. One of his goals as an owner has been to increase and deepen the station's coverage of diversity issues. So Wish threw its resources into covering the unrest, with four crews working on the night of Saturday, May 30th, and going live with reports more than any other station. And also in this week's paper, Anthony Shetley reports on the run on bicycles at local bike shops, as riding has surged in popularity during pandemic lockdowns. You can read all these stories in the latest issue of IBJ or online at ibj.com. And remember, for full and unfettered access to all of IBJ's award-winning business content, just click the subscribe button. Hey, thanks again for making time this week for the IBJ podcast, which is edited by Leslie Weidenbender. I'm Mason King. Hang in there, folks. We'll be back again next week.